In the coming week, Americans face the fallout of the violent pro-Trump riots that overtook the U.S. Capitol and question how these events will affect the country and the world. It's January 7th, 2021, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, there are times when we take our prepared scripts and toss them to respond to breaking developments or bigger than life developments. And that was certainly what occurred this past 24 hours when the U.S. Capitol was breached by rioters, essentially, who started out as protesters supportive of President Trump's claims that the elections have been fraudulently stolen. They breached the Capitol, overran it, interrupted a constitutional process on validating the election of President-elect Joe Biden. After that occurred, by the way, four people were killed in the process. After that occurred, they came back and voted and did certify the election. But I wanted to kick off and have you sort of recap a little bit more about what we know about what happened, and then we could maybe talk through what's coming next.
Certainly, Bob. What we saw yesterday was a mob attack on Capitol Hill, on Congress, something that we have never seen in American history. It was an attack that was egged on by a president who keeps insisting against all evidence that he lost. Now, we can quibble about whether this was a riot, an insurrection, sedition. It's essentially domestic terrorism. And it's certainly an outrage. And it shows how pernicious our political conversation has become here in the United States, that for some people, this was actually a thinkable, undoable thing. Before we get into details, though, I do want to go back and emphasize a point you made and what shouldn't be lost in this conversation, as important as it is. And that's the two other things that happened yesterday. One, Democrats winning both the seats in the Georgia Senate races, meaning the Democrats now have control of the United States Senate. And the second thing being that Congress came back after this mob attack and confirmed Joe Biden as president of the United States come January 20th.
Well, Jim, I want to come back to one aspect of this, which is the security part of this event that unfolded. As our colleague Bruce Hoffman points out on CFR.org today, the relative ease with which these rioters were able to breach security. Capitol Hill has its own police force. I think it's almost 2,000 people. It sends shudders through people who basically something that was unfathomable, which is one of the bastions of U.S. democracy being breached. So can you talk a little bit about what is known about how that occurred, how something seemingly preventable was allowed to happen?
Bob, you're asking a question that a lot of people are asking today in the aftermath of the mob takeover on Capitol Hill. And they're asking it because the Capitol Hill police seemed totally unprepared for the protest to turn violent, even though all the evidence one could detect in the weeks coming up is that this was going to be a very angry crowd, call it a mob, that was going to show up. I think there's also going to be a lot of conversation about how the Capitol Hill police actually handled the protesters. There's been video of police taking selfies with the protesters. We've also seen video of Capitol Hill police fleeing, no doubt in fear for their lives, from this angry mob. I expect that the House and Senate, which control the Capitol Hill police, will do an investigation. Tim Ryan, who's the chair of the House committee that controls appropriations for Capitol Hill police, came out within hours of the attack on Capitol Hill, saying he expected to see some people get fired, and we'll have lots of reports on that. But I think as we pay attention to that slice of the problem, we shouldn't let it take us away from considering the broader context of this problem. And it's a much more difficult conversation for us to have. And that is, to what extent has our political leadership created the conditions for what we saw yesterday? That begins first and foremost with President Trump and the speech he gave at the Ellipse, which essentially egged on his crowd. It has to do with the process we went through yesterday in which members of Congress protested against the confirmation or certification of Biden's vote, again, even in the face of incontrovertible evidence that Biden won the election. And I note that several members of Congress defended their decision to protest the vote in Arizona by saying their constituents were upset or angry or believed that things had been done unfairly. And the answer that I think really came in the speech that Senator Mitt Romney gave, and I would encourage people to watch it, in which he said the answer to that situation is not to feed into people's conspiracy theories, but to stand up and tell them the truth, that Joe Biden won. He won the election fair and square, and he's going to be president of the United States. So I think we're going to have a real painful conversation about to what extent people in Congress, particularly in the Republican Party, have fanned the flames that rose up and consumed the Capitol yesterday.
Those are all good points, Jim. As you were speaking, it also, you know, made me think about the country's experience with populism and really in modern day, really in a century or more, I don't think many Americans have been exposed to populism on the national level before. And this is sort of the ultimate zenith of it in some ways, in terms of in malign ways. We have a populist president in this country. There's no other way around saying that, who has aligned himself with this protest movement, who is fanning this sense of grievance. And in recent days was coming to call the elections a landslide victory that had been robbed from him and his constituents. His inaccuracies and the danger of his comments is such that even the major social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, and now Facebook-owned Instagram, are blocking him from communicating on those platforms, which is sort of an unheard-of development, among other things. There was some talk, it's a fluid story, there was some talk about some Republicans talking about whether or not it was possible to even remove him from office. I think that seems to be a tough road to go down.
Agreed, Bob. Impeachment is theoretically possible, but the time it takes to implement the congressional procedures on impeaching and then trying a president makes it essentially impossible to get it done before Trump's term ends. There's a lot more talk about invoking the 25th Amendment. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and soon-to-be Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer joined a large number of other Democrats today in calling for Trump to remove from office via the 25th Amendment. Now, that's never happened before. It would require both Mike Pence and a majority of the cabinet determined that Trump is no longer capable of carrying out his duties. That provision was written with physical incapacity in mind, say like a stroke that Woodrow Wilson had late in his presidency, and not as some sort of substitute for impeachment. Now, the amendment, the 25th Amendment, allows the president to contest his removal, but the time required to do that would take more than the 13 days that are left in Trump's term. Now, there are no signs that Vice President Pence or members of the Trump cabinet are willing to take this step. I should note that Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation, and Mitch McConnell's wife has just resigned over yesterday's events. And of course, removing the president from office for reasons other than health could set a precedent that we might one day rue.
It does raise questions, Jim, about the immediate future, which is less than 2 weeks to Inauguration Day, how this president handles these final moments in office, where you still have millions of supporters of him who are angry. And these were events, by the way, that while the major action was in Washington, there were other manifestations around the country of Trump supporters who were upset and who took action against official, you know, state buildings and so forth. So we have a nationwide issue here driven by populism, but also I think the social media, the echo chambers we talked about in previous podcasts, Jim. And it's going to be something where, yes, there's this immediate kind of gathering around U.S. institutions to try to preserve them, but also to talk about how these grievances evolved and then what is the responsibility of politicians in taking responsibility for this to avoid this kind of thing happening, whether it's at the federal, state, local level or whatever. Recently, I think the New Hampshire governor wasn't able to have a public ceremony marking his third term in office because of demonstrations in New Hampshire. So we're talking about something that's a nationwide problem as well. And it's like, who takes responsibility, but also who leads the effort to kind of, you know, bring the country around?
Well, you're certainly right, Bob. And I think it's worth noting that not only do we have the terrible occurrence on Capitol Hill yesterday, but in Kansas, the state chambers there, the state house, were breached by right-wing protesters. The Washington governor's home was also breached. We've talked previously in the past about armed protesters showing up at the Michigan state capitol. Now, again, I think this is a small portion of the American electorate that is involved in this, and I don't want to paint too broad a brush, but they are quite clearly very empowered or feel that they are empowered. I mean, the remarkable thing about yesterday was the clear sense of entitlement that people had to break into the Capitol of the United States. The videos and Twitter photos that were posted of people breaking into members' offices, the gentleman who had his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk, the gentleman sitting in the speaker's chair in the House chambers. There's a real sense of people that feel that this is acceptable. And I think the only way to deal with that is, one, to punish people who do this. There were a variety of laws broken yesterday that can be enforced to put the perpetrators in jail where they belong. But I think, secondly, you have to have leaders, political leaders, stand up and make clear that this behavior is unacceptable, and not to wink at it or to write tweets or to give speeches that inflame it. And the reality is that's only going to come from the Republican side of the aisle. And the real challenging thing, Bob, is that you have in recent months, and certainly in the last few days and in the last 24 hours, seen a number of prominent Republicans stand up and level these criticisms. And so far, the response from this part of the American electorate is not to say, you know what, you're right. It's to denounce those people speaking out as apostates, as traitors to the cause. We've already seen, you know, the president attack his vice president, Mike Pence, because Vice President Pence refused to create this authority out of thin air in which he gets to overturn the results of the American people. I know just before we sat down, former Attorney General Bill Barr issued a statement criticizing what the president has done. You've seen Mitt Romney, you've seen a number of others take to the stage, but at least initially, that seems simply to be further aggravating this slice of the electorate.
Yeah, and I think it's these sort of age-old questions that we've certainly talked about in terms of in the context of other countries many times before, you know, governance, rule of law, democratic norms. All of these things are not actually mundane, you know, aspects, but are things that need to be taken seriously, that need to be repeated and fought over and defended, I think, at this point in the country's history, Jim. And I think what also happened yesterday was happening against the backdrop of the raging pandemic. And it's worth noting that I saw some figure that close to 3,800 people died of coronavirus-related illness yesterday, which I think is a new record. The country's death toll is now over 360,000. We have a new administration poised to come in that's planning to take a much stronger federalized approach to enforcing mandates and communicating directives to get the pandemic under control and issue vaccines and so forth. It's going to need the buy-in from politicians, from local officials, from the public. And that is looking like a really tough path as well. I mean, it's also worth noting, so many of the demonstrators who became rioters yesterday were not wearing masks. Not sure whether that's going to turn into a super spreader event or not, but it's something that remains a really tough issue in this country, unique among the developed world, I would say, in terms of the pushback against federally imposed mandates, whether it's something as basic as wearing a mask. But certainly any kind of lockdowns that come, if there's a new strain of the variant that's hitting like the UK, for example, Jim, the response in countries like the UK has been severe lockdown measures. Yep. Trying to enforce that in the US seems like a really tough test at this point.
Well, it's certainly going to be. And that takes us back to the big question. Will the events of yesterday kill what might be called Trumpism? This nationalist, xenophobic, conspiratorial mindset that has taken over a significant portion of the American public. And I don't know if you have a sense of whether or not Trumpism is going to continue or not. Obviously, for a Biden presidency trying to tackle a wide range of things, not just the pandemic, it's going to matter what extent that sort of worldview continues on. The more significant it is, the harder it's going to be to take on the vast number of challenges the United States faces.
Yeah, and this is probably a good point to mention, you know, what that means for the U.S. turning out to the rest of the world. Already, you had countries around the world, allies and foes, intently watching the U.S. political cycle this past year, including the post-election period. And now it was really striking to see the responses to, you know, the footage that was coming out of the Capitol yesterday. And you had cynicism and the scorn, really, of a number of Russian political leaders about the U.S. sort of holding up itself as a democratic bastion and sort of lecturing other countries, something Russia's always chafed against. But you also had U.S. allies, you had Boris Johnson condemning what happened. You had Angela Merkel expressing really strong regret about the way things have unfolded in the U.S. All sorts of European leaders across the spectrum concerned. And then the jibes from U.S. foes, from Venezuela or illiberal countries like Turkey as well. For the U.S. to turn around and then in any way seek to promote, stabilize, sustain democracies around the world is going to be yet another tough task on top of other tough tests that are facing the United States.
You're certainly right, Bob. Yesterday's events were a big blow to American soft power, and autocrats around the world, beginning in Beijing but not ending there, are making the most out of it, pointing to the United States and saying the United States, in a sense, is a fraud, it's incapable, it's incompetent, and that its democracy is a mirage. And that's going to take a toll on our ability to get things done abroad. But I think the problem goes well beyond that. It isn't simply that that Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela can say unkind things about us, or President Erdogan in Turkey can snipe at the United States, I think is going to make it a lot harder for us to work with our traditional friends, partners, and allies. Again, there has been great concern among America's closest allies about where the United States is heading. Many people outside of the United States don't look at the past 4 years as an aberration. They worry that it is the beginning of a new, more nationalist, more self-centered America. When they're beginning to think about what kind of deals they should do, what kind of choices they make, they have in the back of their head the great concern that even if Joe Biden comes in and says all the right things and tries to do all the right things, that either he will not succeed or whatever he does is going to get swept away in 2024 or 2028. And that's a real problem for American foreign policy, because again, it would be nice if the United States could sort of wave goodbye to the rest of the world, turn in, would stick to its own knitting and not worry about events beyond its borders. But the reality is what happens overseas matters to the United States. On those occasions, over the last 120 years that we've decided not to pay attention to the world beyond our borders, think World War I, World War II, events came back to haunt us. And so we need to work with others, but unfortunately, we are frittering away a lot of our own ability and power. And here we get back to the notion, I think, Joe Biden, first order of business, second order of business, third order of business, isn't going to be to fix America's foreign policy, though he'll no doubt do things along those lines. He's got to address the very real problems Americans face here at home. And again, the question is, can he succeed? Winning control of the Senate is a big boost. It will allow him to do things he couldn't otherwise do if Mitch McConnell and the Republicans controlled the Senate. But again, he's still going to be facing some pretty stiff winds. And the real big issue is, to what extent is Trumpism going to remain a major political force in American politics after January 20th? And I know there are people who are saying, well, what happened on Capitol Hill yesterday really has delegitimated Donald Trump, and he is going to fade as a political force in American politics. And as a result, Republicans can act in a more traditional fashion. I'm not sure that's the case, Bob. The fact that we yesterday went and got to the edge and steered into the abyss doesn't mean that people will count their blessings and retreat. We run the very real risk that this will persist, this kind of politics will persist for quite a while.
Jim, yeah, I can only agree with that. And I'm seizing on a couple of things you mentioned. One was the soft power aspect, because I think as I look at my inbox and I see, you know, this kind of extraordinary amount of feedback and amount of response coming from organizations like Freedom House, the National Endowment for Democracy, even the International Crisis Group, you know, one of the central tenets they seize on and that they're used to dealing with the rest of the world is the peaceful transfer of power. And I think that's at core is what we're talking about here. And this is power in its utmost. The president of the United States, but it applies all the way down to, you know, town council members in the U.S. as well. We're seeing all of this potentially under threat by these aspects of Trumpism, really, which is defying the results that you don't agree with in such a way that you seize power illegally. And I think about when I first, in terms of soft power, I joined the Radio Free Europe back in the early 1990s, and I arrived a couple of months before the U.S. elections in 1992, where Bill Clinton beat George H.W. Bush, seen as abroad very powerful incumbent. And yet this upstart governor from Arkansas comes in and defeats President Bush. President Bush concedes the stage and actually wrote a very graceful, well-distributed note in its aftermath, well-distributed note to incoming President Clinton. And I remember running into one of the directors of Radio Free Europe's Belarusian service at the time. And the first thing he said, he asked me when I came over to Munich, and he just said, just wonderful. And he started talking about the election, which happened the day before, and the fact that a sitting powerful president would cede ground to another newcomer in such a way and peacefully cede power. He's saying something like that would never happen in Belarus. And we're seeing to this day in Belarus, yep. Belarusians are fighting for that, actually, and we continue to as we speak. But it's that sort of core principle that people look to the U.S. as that model. And that also in the case of Radio for Europe, something, an organization that's founded and funded by the U.S. to do that. These are the things that are in jeopardy and that are universal, actually, in terms of universal values maintained by democracy. democracy. So I think, again, yesterday's events contained so many layers of concern. And as you said, Jim, we walked into the abyss, and I'm not sure how far away we've moved from it yet. But I think it's sending ripples across the world. And I do really hope that it has sent enough of a shudder that we have a critical mass of leaders who can pull together on this.
Unfortunately, Bob, I don't see that coalescing taking place. I wish I could be an optimist on that score, but it's very hard for me to look at the dynamics going on right now and come to the conclusion that the American center is going to pull together to resist this extremist behavior and ideology. They'll condemn it. That's quite clear. I am not sure that members of the political elite, particularly on the right side of the spectrum, won't stop feeding that passion.
You know, we had, as a backdrop to the events yesterday, also a confirmation that both Democratic candidates won in Georgia. You referenced that earlier in the podcast, Jim. So is that, in some fashion, this change of power in Congress now, both houses of Congress narrowly, but still in the hands of the Democrats now, as well as the presidency, does that create any sort of interesting new dynamic that we should be watching for? Or is it going to be sort of a very perilous path we're looking at?
Well, I think that the Democrat takeover of the Senate is going to be important for Joe Biden's ability to enact his agenda. We're going to be hearing a lot in the weeks to come about the R word, not Republican, but reconciliation. This is a vehicle that grew up over the years to allow the Senate to get around the filibuster. And I would expect a Biden administration to use reconciliation to get a lot of its legislative agenda through the Senate, even though its control of the Senate is by now narrowest margins. What I don't think is going to happen is having a Democratic Senate contributing to or undercutting this right-wing, xenophobic, conspiratorial take on American politics, where elections are corrupt and they're stolen from President Trump. In many respects, the fact that John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock won in Georgia is going to be used by these conspiracy theorists as confirmation of all of their outlandish stories about how American politics works. So I don't see that in and of itself undercutting. Again, it comes back to who, if anyone, has credibility with this slice of the American electorate to convince them that what they believe is wrong. It's not true. They are being fed a steady diet of lies. And what we've seen to this point is every time someone stands up and says, no, that's not true, they get accused of being a traitor to the cause or having been corrupted or being part of the deep state. I'm not a student of mass psychology, so I'm not sure how one persuades people to give up these essentially fantasies about the way the world is working.
Yeah, and I think it's something where we're going to also have to see how, in reality, the new administration plays out. Again, we'll be taking a close look as we get close to the inauguration and the first 100 days. There's going to be new staff coming in. There's going to be new lawmakers coming in. And even with the narrow margins, you know, it could add a different element to the discourse. Although, again, it's hard to move beyond the dynamics that led to yesterday's sort of overflow and breaching of the Capitol. And really, this sort of toxic environment that we find ourselves in nationwide, Jim.
Certainly, Bob. And I'm glad you offered a bit of optimism there. I mean, I think if there is one way out of the situation we find ourselves in, it is if the Biden administration comes in, is able to enact legislation, put in place policies that begin to show very real results for people, that might be something that can change the conversation, that it could be something which all of a sudden emboldens the center. And maybe you begin to peel off some people who sort of gone down this rabbit hole of conspiracy theories. I hope it plays out that way. I mean, again, the work you and I do is all based on the belief that facts matter, that you can persuade people through a rational conversation, that people can change their minds as they get new information. And the hope would be that a Biden administration is able to succeed, because that would be good, not for Democrats. It would be good for the United States of America.
And that's our look at the world next week through the prism of a U.S. democratic crisis. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Germany's ruling Christian Democratic Party plans to pick its new head. Elections are held in both Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. And North Koreans celebrate the birthday of leader Kim Jong-un.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlin. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collins. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.